And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us. Great to be with you again after a long weekend. There's much going on in presidential politics, and we'll get to some of that today, but more of that tomorrow. We'll have the results of the primaries, and we'll have wall-to-wall politics tomorrow. Also, sometime this week, I'd like to take a look at what is going on in Bennington with the issue of water contamination. It's a big issue down there, and probably a big concern for most Vermonters here these days. It's really something that is prevalent. We've talked about Flint, Michigan. What's going on in Bennington is something that really needs to concern us. But I want to start out today with a subject you first heard on this program at the start of the legislative session. When we interviewed Senator John Campbell, who's the Senate Pro Tem, and also Senator Jane Kitchell, who was the chair of the Appropriations Committee, when they sort of talked about the need for the Agency of Human Service to be reorganized. And as you look at what's happening in the legislature, as you look at some of the attention that it's getting in the press, this is starting to get some momentum in terms of maybe it's time to reorganize the Agency of Human Services. So we'll explore that question for about the first 30 minutes of the program. We'll explore the question, should AHS, the Agency of Human Services, be split up? Is it too big? Is it too cumbersome? Is it too diverse to be effective nowadays in modern government? And then we'll turn to politics and speak with John Walters of the Vermont Political Observer. We'll talk about politics, presidential politics, state politics, and would welcome your phone calls in terms of any sort of issues that you want to talk about in the area of politics and public policy. And then we'll speak with Neil Lunderville, who's the general manager of Burlington Electric Department, about issues that involve utilities, power generation, energy efficiency, siting, which has been a big issue here in Vermont. We'll talk to Neil about that. But first up, want to spend, like I said, the next 25 minutes or so on this question. Should the Agency of Human Services be split up? If you have an opinion, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 1-877-291-8255. Should the Agency of Human Services be split up? And let me give you some background on this so you have some knowledge of where this is coming from. We talked to Jane Kitchell, who's chair of the Senate, Senator Jane Kitchell, who's chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and we talked to John Campbell, who is the Senate Pro Tem, Senator John Campbell, Senate Pro Tem. And what they believe is that the agency has grown too big. And under Jane Kitchell believes that you should split out the health care issues, the health care functions from the agency into a new agency called the Agency of Healthcare Administration. And this has won quite a unanimous approval from the Senate Government Ops Committee. The proposal is not supported by the administration. The Secretary of Human Services, Hal Cohn, said it's not a great idea because it's a move that's, in his words, it says moves us steps backwards, because to break up, and this is a quote from Hal Cohn, the secretary, to break that up would really break up the whole concept of integration. There is also a House bill that is being considered, and that would create an independent office to oversee the child protection system. The administration also thinks that that's unnecessary because there are multiple layers, multiple bureaucracies of protection right now, and they think this would be adding a layer of bureaucracy. So what do you think? Is the agency too big? Is it too diverse? Is it too cumbersome? is it too hard to manage now that it has so many things that's involved? It's about a 4,000 person agency, if I remember correctly. The budget is half of state government. So, you know, and I've got to admit, I had something to do with moving portions of healthcare out of AHS when I moved from Secretary of Human Services to Secretary of Administration, because I had started paying attention to healthcare with what was called the global commitment, a method of funding Medicaid. And when we started Catamount Health, I was at the Agency of Human Services, and it was easier for me to bring the whole responsibilities with me. But I'm not sure organizationally it was the right thing to do. At the time, it was efficient and it was effective, but the Shumlin administration does have a point. Could you lose coordination by splitting healthcare out of the Agency of Human Services into this new agency of healthcare that is spoken about in the Senate bill? You know, one of the things that I remember quite vividly was that the agency, when it focused, it did a tremendous job at bringing all the resources to a particular problem. And one of those problems was an experiment called the Incarcerated Women's Initiative. The mission was to smash down the bureaucratic barriers within the agency and address the alarming increase in women going to prison. And what the agency did is made it a challenge for the whole agency, not just corrections, not just one department. And this led to a unified effort. So the administration does have a point when they talk about the ability to integrate, to address problems in a unified way. You know, when the agency looked at this Incarcerated Women's Initiative, this led to investments in drug counseling, drug treatment centers, education and job training opportunities, improvements to the foster care system, access to mental health services, housing, and the application of enhanced services. It was an integrated approach. It was a success in taking the agency and moving it forward in a way that it hadn't been before. I mean, breaking up the agency, and be interested in your opinion, breaking up the agency, taking healthcare functions out of the agency, wouldn't it be similar to Apple breaking away its iPhone business because it distracts them, you know, making it into a separate company away from its iPads and Mac applications and company because it's a distraction and it would be easier to have a separate company? That's kind of the analogy here that at least I'm drawing, is that it's become too complicated. It diverts attention away, so we break it out. But once you break it out, the integration sort of loses steam. Now, the comeback to that is all of state government needs to integrate. And that is, there's some truth to that. But does the agency really benefit from breaking out healthcare from it? The question is, should we be sort of splitting up the Agency of Human Services? If you've got an opinion, give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. You know, there's no doubt, and I can understand why people are thinking about this. There is no doubt that healthcare and the administration of our system, healthcare system, is a mess. But doesn't that have to do more with competence than with organization? So what do you think? Do you think the Agency of Human Services is too big? Should it be split up? Give me a call at 1777 if you've got an opinion, or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone lines, and let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Good morning, Mike. Hey, the answer to your question in the simplest terms is yes, the Human Services Agency is too big, and it can be split up, and it can be split up without losing any ability to integrate across services. And I say this because with as much surety as I do, because of the plain simple fact, we're past the information age where we have the infrastructure to gather and share information, and we're into what I've heard referred to by, particularly in a book came from a gentleman you might be familiar with, a General Al Gray, who wrote a book on leadership, which is about the only book of that genre I ever enjoyed reading. But he talked about how we were now into the judgment phase, and I don't mean that as a, he didn't mean it either as a religious judgment, but how we use the information. And this is what makes it possible to spread out organizations as opposed to have these monolithic structures. We need to get away from this factory model, and this is what you have with the Agency of Human Services. And I don't mean this in a derogatory manner, but just in an administrative manner, that you have this top-down flow, and if you break that top-down flow, there's the fear that you'll lose the coordination as things flow down. But the truth is, organizations all around the world, much less the country, have shown that by making good use of communications technology and by having good judgment in how we use the information, you don't lose any efficiencies. As a matter of fact, you probably gain efficiencies because as you get to smaller organizations, you become a lot more nimble and being able to change to meet very localized requirements and demands.
Hey, thanks, Rama, for the phone call. And by the way, that sort of leads me to an issue. I want to get back to Rama's question, you know, in terms of integration, which is a good one, by the way. But I also want to sort of lead on to something else that Rama brought up. It's the term, you know, IT. And one of the projects, there's a massive project going that is planned in Human Services, which is the replacement of what is called the Access System, which is the main computer system of AHS, the Agency of Human Services. And it's going to be a massive cost. I mean, $500 million to more that we're talking about. And yet there was an attempt to go out to bid. That attempt has been pulled back. And now the Senate Institutions Committee is asking a whole host of questions. And if you remember, we had the chair of that committee, Peg Flory, Senator Peg Flory from Rutland, on our show talking about that. And she's confused what's going on with the money. So far on this project that they have pulled and announced they would cancel the procurement and start over again, they have spent $39.2 million in federal money and $3.9 million in state money on the integrated eligibility project so far. What's interesting is that the Senate Institutions Committee is trying to get to the bottom of what's being spent and why it's being spent. And Senator Peg Flory is quoted in a news article as saying she's called herself impatient and frustrated that the administration has canceled its testimony in her committee twice. And what they want to know, and this is a quote from Peg Flory, my basic question is the same question that I asked them last year, and I asked everybody on IT. Why do we need it? What does it do? What's the cost? What's the annual operating cost? What's the life expectancy? And how are you going to measure success? And so far, the Senate Institutions Committee doesn't feel that it's got the right answers. Let me sort of address Rama's issue in terms of, given the fact that you have these IT systems that can communicate, it doesn't necessarily have to mean that you have this monolithic infrastructure in terms of an agency of human services. And yeah, that could be. But there is something to say of having an integrated structure in order to get things done as well. But I agree with Rama on one thing, that we must break down the bureaucratic barriers in order to make that function. I don't care if they're separate. I don't care if they're together. I think I would prefer them to be together, given my experience in managing organizations. But you have to break down these barriers. The fear is that if you have a separate agency, that just sets up another barrier. Because the way that we deal with human services now is not how we used to deal with human services. You could easily segregate the issues in terms of how you dealt with them. You can no longer do that. I mean, our societal problems manifest themselves on a broad range of things across the spectrum. You know, they deal with unsafe homes, irresponsible parents, drug and alcohol addiction, domestic violence, the lack of education, access to mental health care or adequate housing, multi-generational poverty, or even inadequate employment opportunities. These are a host of difficulties that need to be addressed. And Rama brought something up. The old compartmentalized approach, you can't do it that way. And you won't be able to address these problems in a compartmental way, the way that we talked. I'm unsure that making another compartment by making an agency really helps that, but relying on the old system won't work. I mean, it's going to cause continued frustration, and it's going to trap so many Vermonters into this hopelessness, this feeling of hopelessness. But these, you know, we're a small state, and we can make these issues, we can solve these issues, and we have a dedicated workforce, and I know they're willing to break the mold to solve complex problems. All we need is the leadership and support to do this. If you have an opinion on what we should do with the Agency of Human Services, should we break it up? Should we keep it as it is right now? Is it competence or is it organization? Give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Bill and Barry. Bill, you're on open mic.
Good morning, Mike. Every time you break up something, you add people. And the state right now has enough financial problems. They don't really want to add people. If you take this agency and break it up into two separate ones, you end up with two agency leaders and their staff off to the start. But the funny thing was, I worked for the state for many years, and one of the places I've been was the health department, and they did do what they called a consolidation. They consolidated different divisions because they had about 10, 11 divisions, so they shortened it to 5. And ended up with a larger staff. So it seems that if a private company, like I think you said Apple, breaks things up, they are a profit-making organization. They have to make a profit. They're not collecting taxes. So they can do that if it creates more sales and helps them do that. But when the state has to rely on its income from taxes, then and they do things like break up or consolidate, both cases, they can add people, and all they have to do is tax.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for the phone call. The question is, should we split up the Agency of Human Services? Has it become too big, too cumbersome? It can't address problems. Too diverted with its attention on health care. There is a proposal in the legislature to form a separate agency of healthcare administration that would take the healthcare aspect out of the Agency of Human Services. seems to be gaining steam in the Senate. Unanimous vote out of Government Operations Committee, being spearheaded by Senator Jane Kitchell, who herself used to be Secretary of Human Services. Being opposed by the administration, the Human Service Secretary Hal Cohn says it breaks up that integration. The legislation would do away with the agency's current six department structures. And currently, that comprises of the Vermont Health Access, Health Department, Mental Health Department, Corrections, Department of Corrections, DCF, Department of Children and Families, and DALE, Disabilities, Aging, and Independent Living. The new agency would include the new departments of Health Access, Mental Health and Substance Abuse, Long-Term Care, and Public Health, as well as a health care board and the Vermont Health Benefit Exchange. So it would take, including Medicaid, it looks like, take all of that out of the Agency of Human Services and leave the agency mostly focused on corrections and children as we look at it. If you have an opinion of whether the Agency of Human Services should be split up, should be kept the same, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I'm going to stick with this subject for just a few more minutes. So if you have any opinions in terms of what should happen, should it be split up? Should it be kept the same? Is it a question of competence or a question of organization? That's the question that we're asking this morning. And it's going to be interesting. This has an enormous impact in terms of how we deliver services to Vermonters. You know, we talk about all these things, and it's fun to talk about presidential and state politics, and we'll do that in just a minute with John Walters from the Vermont Political Observer. But in terms of impact, this has enormous impact. About half the state employees are with the Agency of Human Services. About half the state budget is under the auspices of the Agency of Human Services. And it is a major impact on Vermonters. Over 30% of Vermonters are on Medicaid. Perhaps a greater percentage interacts with the Agency of Human Services. So it is a big deal in terms of what impacts everyday Vermonters. When we return, we'll talk with John Walters from Vermont Political Observer. We'll talk state and federal politics, state and national politics. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome in our WDEV studios, John Walters from the Vermont Political Observer. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mike. I was listening to you on the way in, and it brought to mind a thought, kind of reaching across the partisan aisle here, that one of the things that's missing from our highly partisan politics today is the idea of actually trying to make government work. You know, the Republicans are against government, and Democrats are for government, and I grew up in Michigan. And under Republican governors George Romney and Bill Milliken. And in a lot of ways, they were kind of like, you know, George Aiken, Dick Snelling, people like that, who, you know, were conservative, but they really wanted to make government work as well as it possibly could for the benefit of the people. And that's kind of been lost in our politics. We're just off on the extreme positions, and there's no really trying to make government efficient and make it, you know, do what it's supposed to do for all of us.
Well, you raise a good point, and that was sort of the purpose of the discussion, to get people to think about things that really are going to affect people. Mm-hmm. and how that works and important stuff. I mean, we're going to turn to the fun stuff right now. But that takes a lot of energy, it takes a lot of initiative, it takes a lot of thought about how we're going to do that.
Well, I wrote about something just this morning, the Blue Ribbon Tax Commission, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that was a real bipartisan effort to come up with real solutions. And they came up with some really good ideas, and there it sits on a shelf somewhere. I don't know.
Well, let's talk about something that's going to be filed today, and those are the campaign finance reports from the gubernatorial candidates, lieutenant candidates, all the sort of statewide offices that us junkies sort of really enjoy looking at. Why do we enjoy looking at this?
Well, it's our way of keeping score, you know, especially in a state like Vermont where there aren't very many opinion polls. This is our way of assessing the financial and potentially the organizational strength of candidates. And it's kind of a rough measure of their appeal. You know, if somebody like Phil Scott gets a lot of money, then obviously he has some appeal, at least to the donors. Especially this report, because the way Vermont system is set up, we haven't had reports since last July. It's been a very long time. So this will be a really good sort of one snapshot of where the race is at this point in time.
And one of the things we were surprised about last July was the amount of money that Matt Dunn had raised.
Yeah.
Do we expect a strong performance from him?
I would think so. I mean, he put out kind of a blitz effort in June and early July so that he could put up an impressive total in that July 15th reporting time. And he did. He got over $100,000, which is amazing money for a year and a half before the election. You know, I would expect him to come in with a big number. I'm sure his campaign is trying to do that. I would expect his Democratic counterpart, Sue Minter, to come in probably with less money. She just recently got the endorsement from Emily's List, and that is going to provide a fundraising boost for her, but I'm sure it hasn't materialized yet. I suppose the big question on the Democratic side is, will Dunn have rolled up enough of a financial advantage that he might discourage any potential other candidates from getting into the race? And, you know, that's one of the questions I'll be looking to get a read on tonight.
You know, it sort of reminds me at the close of the bell, the market, what we're expecting with the market. Mm-hmm. It is expectations here. It's all about expectations, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, Sue Minter's expectations are lower than Matt Dunn's. If they come in about even, then that'll be a shock. And it might be a measure that Matt Dunn has kind of hit a glass ceiling. You know, similarly on the Republican side, we're kind of expecting Phil Scott to roll in with a very impressive fundraising total. My interest on the Republican side will be to see what Bruce Lisman reports. He did very poorly in a recent poll. Is he attracting donors? Is he putting a lot of his own money into his campaign? Is he really bankrolling a serious effort to, you know, unseat or to defeat Phil Scott? Or has he kind of given up on it? That'll be something I'm really looking forward to seeing.
One of the things you recently wrote about is the public finance ruling, and there's two questions I have in there. First of all, the public financing ruling, could you sort of explain what that is and why it makes a difference in the lieutenant governor's race, but also the press conference that Matt Dunn and Galbraith had? I want to get to that as well. So first question first, public financing ruling by the U.S. court, district court, what does it mean and why is it important?
Well, the federal judge ruled that Vermont's public financing law, as clunky and unwieldy as it might be, is not actually unconstitutional, and that's not a terrible surprise. To me, I think the public financing system seems to be designed to discourage candidates rather than encourage them. The bar is set very high for qualification, and then after you qualify and after you receive public financing, the law, the rules on what other benefits you can accrue, financial or otherwise, in kind, are very tight. You know, Dean Corin, who ran for lieutenant governor 2 years ago, ran afoul of a kind of an obscure interpretation of the public financing law, and he's facing a possible $72,000 fine for what was really kind of a piddling violation, if it even was a violation. So it seems to me that, you know, the immediate impact of this is Dean Corin still has to face that fine. David Zuckerman, State Senator David Zuckerman, who was hoping to qualify for public financing, won't be able to.
And that's because he started his campaign before the law allows.
Yeah, and he was hoping for a court ruling and then a legislative rewrite of the law, and that would open the door for him to pursue public financing. That door is now closed to him. But I think in the longer term, it sets the question before the legislature again, you know, is this really a good public financing system? Do we want any public financing system? My argument is either we should get a better one that actually encourages unfunded candidates, or we should just do away with it and say, you know, it's not worth the effort.
Also, the last week we had a press conference, an unusual press conference. We had Matt Dunn, who's a candidate for governor, with Peter Galbraith, who is thinking about to be a candidate for governor, talking about that they're not going to take, well, Matt Dunn, on Matt Dunn's case, not taking corporate contributions, but he'll take other sort of contributions,
right.
You know, from individuals or from parties or from people that are, you know, it got confusing to say the least, and what was taking and what wasn't taking.
Well, in one case, a man who had given Matt Dunn some money through his corporate checkbook actually took back the check and rewrote the same check from his private account. So that makes it okay, I guess.
And candidates always get tripped up with that, with trying to sort of to thread the needle in terms of this campaign finance. It seems like either it's one way all the way or one way all the way with that. You can't sort of thread the needle here.
Yeah, and corporate contributions, it seems to me, I mean, corporate is kind of a dirty word in liberal circles, but, you know, corporations are part of life. And corporate contributions do not seem to me to be that much of a big deal in Vermont. There just isn't that much, you know, gross tonnage of money in Vermont. And I really haven't seen it. So that the issue doesn't exercise me too much. What kind of happened at the news conference with Matt Dunn and Peter Galbraith is that the latter kind of usurped the whole thing and made it into a platform for him to muse on whether he's going to run for governor or not. And in the process, he made Matt Dunn rather visibly uncomfortable, forced to stand there with a frozen smile on his face and watch Peter Galbraith take over the proceedings. Galbraith has been an opponent of corporate contributions for many years, and that's always struck me as just a little bit disingenuous because he's a rich man. You know, he has tens of millions, if not, you know, nine figures of wealth from investments in the Middle Eastern oil industry that sort of came about through his relationships with the Kurds. So, you know, he can self-fund a campaign. He doesn't need corporate contributions, whereas someone like a Sue Minter, you know, who is reluctant to ban corporate contributions, might need some of that money in order to compete with a rich man like a, you know, Peter Galbraith or a Bruce Lisman.
Let's turn to the governor's race. Is Peter Galbraith getting in?
Well, he sure as heck would like to. I mean, that was his original plan when he moved to Vermont, you know, after his diplomatic service was done. He openly talked about running in 2008, and he ultimately did not. He ran for state senate in 2010, and I think he found that to be too small a platform for his liking. So I expect him to run. What effect he has on the race, I have no idea. You know, there are sort of a couple of permutations of this hypothetical triangle with Sue Minter, Matt Dunn, and Peter Galbraith. One is that Galbraith's argument is that he would be the real progressive in the race. Dunn and Minter are sort of more moderate Democrats, so maybe Galbraith gets the left-wing vote, and Dunn and Minter cancel each other out. On the other hand, maybe two men in the race, you know, heightens Sue Minter's advantage as the woman in a Democratic contest, and that gives her the edge. I really don't know which way that would break out. And then there's another wild card potentially in the deck, which is that House Speaker Shap Smith is apparently still mulling the possibility of a late entry into the governor's race, depending on his wife's health. So, It does. After we thought it was the field was set months ago, now suddenly we might have some additional drama.
What about on the Republican side? Anything going on there?
Well, you know, like I said a few minutes ago, I'm waiting to see Bruce Lisman's campaign finance report to see whether he is really throwing serious money into this race. Right now, you know, he holds a lot of events, he gets around a lot, he tweets a lot, and he writes a lot of opinion pieces for the local papers. But, you know, he's going to need a real all-out effort to take on Phil Scott's, you know, built-in advantages, his popularity, his familiarity. Scott is obviously very popular with the Republican establishment in the state. And in Vermont, that's not really as dirty a word as it is in national Republican politics. And of course, the VPR poll showed Phil Scott at 42% and Bruce Lisman at a robust 4%. Lisman is going to have to make a decision, or maybe he already has. Is he really all in? Or is he kind of going to let this thing kind of play out and, you know, take his lumps and go back to his home in Shelburne?
We're speaking with John Walters, who's with Vermont Political Observer. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's turn to the lieutenant governor's race for just a moment. Mm-hmm. Seems like it's quiet. I guess that's the word I'm looking for. Quiet. Yeah. What are you hearing out there?
Not much. I think that right now State Senator David Zuckerman has something of an edge, if only because of his name recognition and his very solid reputation in liberal and progressive circles. And I mean that in both the small P and capital P way. I'm kind of getting the sense that Keisha Ram has not really rung too many people's bells. She would be the Democrat in the race, but whether she is, I don't know. I get the sense that some people think she's really not quite ready for the job. She's still in her 20s, I believe. She's been in the legislature for several years, but is she ready to step up to that extent? I'm not sure.
And we have two other candidates, a candidate from Brattleboro and a candidate from Rutland as well.
Yeah, Brandon Riker is a Democrat, and I met him once when he first announced, and we had a nice chat, but I haven't seen or heard much from him since then. And Dr. Lewis Myers, who is running as an independent, but, you know, he's only lived in the state a few years. He doesn't have any political connections or infrastructure. I have a hard time believing he's going to be a serious candidate. As for Randy Brock, who's the only declared Republican, I believe, and I'm sure they will let him have the nomination if he wants it. It would certainly be an interesting race. Randy Brock is a very conservative guy, but he focuses on policy more than on sort of name-calling and, you know, the ranting and raving. So, you know, a potential contest of David Zuckerman versus Randy Brock would be a real study in policy contrast, but it would be conducted at a very high level. You know, they would really be talking about their ideas and their vision of Vermont, and I think that would be a really nice thing to see.
When we come back, I want to change the subject to presidential politics, because today is a big day and we can't sort of omit what is happening today out there. We're speaking with John Walters from the Vermont Political Observer. When we come back, let's talk presidential politics. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with John Walters, Vermont Political Observer. John, Tom knows this, but I'm a big Supertramp fan, so he keeps playing the intros with Supertramp. One of the things that's happening today, it's a big day in presidential politics. There are five primaries.
Yeah.
What sort of things are you looking for in these primaries?
I'm kind of expecting the same outcome as last Tuesday, where Bernie Sanders does better than expected, but not well enough to close in on Hillary Clinton. You know, last week he won Michigan, quote unquote, but the delegates were apportioned, you know, proportionately. he won 7 more delegates than Hillary did, and that doesn't count the superdelegates.
If you count the superdelegates, he actually lost Michigan.
Yes, but even among pledged delegates, he only picked up 7, and then he lost a whole bunch more than that in Mississippi. So he actually came out of a big night for him further behind Hillary Clinton. And I kind of expect that to happen tonight. He will probably do very well in Ohio and Illinois and probably Missouri as well. And he'll probably do really badly in Florida and badly in North Carolina. And he'll probably come out with a net loss in delegates.
One of the things that Bernie Sanders has had problems with, especially in the South, is the African-American vote. He loses badly in that demographic in with African-Americans. What's going on there?
Like 80 to 90% support for Hillary Clinton. And in Michigan, it was, quote-unquote, only 68% for Hillary Clinton. So even in the northern states, Bernie does not do well among black voters. And that, frankly, to me, is the signature problem with his campaign, the biggest stumbling block for him. I think it was NBC's Chuck Todd who pointed out last Tuesday night that if Bernie were just splitting the black vote, he would be ahead in this race. He has had trouble from the very beginning, and I don't want to sit here and try to interpret what African-American people are thinking or why they are voting the way they did. I think we have to give them the benefit of the doubt. And here's where I've had an argument with some Bernie supporters is they come at me with arguments about why black voters should really vote for Bernie. And
it's mostly economic issues that they talk about.
And some of Hillary's past positions, which frankly a lot of them were actually Bill's past positions, not hers. But anyway, my question to them is, let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that black voters know what they're doing, that they're at least as smart as white voters, and they make their own decisions based on what they see as what's best for their own interests and for the country. Given that assumption, why don't they like Bernie? I don't know. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the Clintons do have a long relationship with people, with the African-American community. I read somewhere interesting, a lot of Sanders supporters have slammed Hillary for her part in sort of the crime crackdown of the 90s during the Bill Clinton administration. And I read something recently that pointed out that at that time, crime was a legitimate concern among all American community, including the African-American community. A lot of black people were really afraid of crime at that point. And a lot of them, frankly, welcomed a crackdown. It didn't go well for their community. It didn't go well for America, really. But at the time, it seemed like an appropriate response. Anyway, let's leave that aside. I think a lot of it is just that Bernie seems a little bit tone deaf. His economic argument doesn't quite jibe with the black experience, I don't think. He has kind of an academic argument. When he's asked about racism, he kind of quickly pivots back to his economic argument, which is basically that this is all about class and wealth and income inequality. And that, you know, racism is kind of a spinoff from that because so many white Americans feel disaffected or left out. And they attack the minority. They attack the other. But when Bernie does that, he kind of delegitimizes the experience that black people have of, you know, racism as being something that hurts them directly personally. You know, that they feel it. They feel it from white people, from other people. And it's not an abstract thing to them. It's not, you know, sociology 101 or political science or anything like that. It is their experience. And I think that Bernie, without meaning to do so, kind of slightly marginalizes the experience of black people. And I think that's why his message hasn't resonated. And I think that any Democratic candidate who's serious, especially on the left side, really has to aim for a rainbow coalition of some sort and start the campaign from that point. Because, you know, African Americans and Hispanics and other minorities are a big part of the Democratic coalition. And I think you need to take that into account.
If Donald Trump runs the table today, is it over? For the Republic, I mean, in terms of the nomination.
The nomination. Well, yeah, if he wins Ohio and Florida, it would be hard to stop him. If he only wins one of the two, it would still be possible to stop him. If he loses both of them, both Ohio and Florida, then it would get really messy because he would clearly, he would almost certainly get through the process with a delegate lead, but without a majority. And then you'll have lots of fun at the Republican convention. So, yeah, the big thing tonight, I guess, is Ohio, because John Kasich is very strong there. So we'll see.
One of the things I wanted to sort of follow up on in presidential politics is Governor Dean has been really vocal on Twitter lately, and he's complained about the Bernie supporters bombarding him for his support, his superdelegate support of Hillary Clinton.
Right.
I'm curious, first of all, I don't know why he's responding, but second of all, do you think the superdelegate support of Patrick Leahy to Hillary Clinton will have an impact on his election in any way here in the state?
No. I think the first thing would have to be the Republicans would have to come up with a credible candidate with enough money to compete with Pat Leahy, and I don't see that happening unless there's somebody hiding out in the weeds I don't know about. Pat Leahy's either going to be unopposed or he's going to have a very token, probably Tea Party-type Republican with no money facing him. So, there's a little bit of hard feelings, but, you know, a lot of that's going to pass, and heck, it might, you know, drop Pat Leahy's share of the vote from, 74% to 68%. but I think he's going to win re-election.
This is really unfair. 30 seconds. Norm McAllister, you've been writing about his effort to come back to the Senate. He's petitioned the Senate to come back.
Yeah, he seems to be completely disassociated from reality, and I'm sure your Republican friends in Franklin County are just tearing their hair out about this, because I think he's going to run for re-election. You know, he obviously thinks he's done nothing wrong and he should still be in the Senate. Why wouldn't he run for re-election? And then the Republicans in Franklin County are going to have him around their neck until his court proceeding runs its course, his trial, and whatever appeal might be filed. And, you know, we could be going into the November election with Norm McAllister on the ballot. Good grief.
John Walters, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. John Walters from Vermont Political Observer, who does a lot of observation about what's going on in politics. Visit his blog at, John, what is it again?
TheVPO.org.
Thanks, John. John Walters. Coming up, a check with our friends at Talk Media News, and then Neil Lunderville, General Manager of Burlington Electric Department. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And, of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Upcoming, we'll check in with our friends at Talk Media News, and then Neil Lunderville, General Manager of Burlington Electric Department. Let's go to our friend in D.C. at Talk Media News, Ellen Ratner. Ellen, good morning.
Good morning. Well, I wish I was in D.C. I'm actually in New York, and I will be on Fox News Channel from 1 a.m. to 4 a.m. And, you know, people always say Fox News, but actually a third of the viewers on Fox News are Dems.
Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Because people want to tune in to what the other side is saying. They want to know.
Hey, Ellen, what are you expecting today?
Well, boy, I am a bad predictor, so you don't want to talk to me. But listen, Bernie Sanders is doing better in Ohio than expected. He is doing better in Hillary's home state of Illinois than expected. He's not doing so well in Florida, but... You know, it's going to be how many delegates does each person get? And, you know, it's not winner take all like the Republicans are in Ohio and Florida.
What do you expect on the Republican side? Is Donald Trump having a big day today?
Well, he won 9 delegates of Northern Mariana Islands, and he was endorsed by the governor there. And now that's only 9 delegates, but that's something, and that shows that he's coming into this with something.
What else is happening that you
want to... Okay, so we have a lot of international news. We know that Mr. Putin pulled out of Syria. He had a phone call with the president. The White House issued a release yesterday on this. But what's so interesting about this release is that the release actually is, you know, it didn't say anything. So we don't really know why he pulled out, other than, as a friend of mine said, when we were in Iraq, you know, 13 years ago or 12 years ago, I guess it was 13 years ago, why don't we call in the blue hats, that's the United Nations, declare victory and go home? And I think that's what President Putin is doing, clearly, because we don't know why he pulled out. All we know is that he pulled out. And, of course, now we also have the Iran situation with the missiles. It was not covered under the agreement, but it was implied under the agreement, but not directly. So Iran feels that they can test missiles.
And the problem with testing the missiles is, from our perspective, is those missiles can carry nuclear warheads. And that's the problem from that, right?
That's exactly right. And that's what we don't know. And, of course, we do know that Kim Jong-un is saying, well, they have a hydrogen bomb. Nobody believes them. But, you know, just like with Saddam Hussein, his people were afraid to tell him they didn't have that weapons of mass destruction. I think that in North Korea, they're afraid to tell him that they don't really have a hydrogen bomb.
Ellen, what else is happening out there that we should be aware of?
Well, I think that the only other interesting thing, obviously, then the elections, which is top and center today, is that there is going to be a Supreme Court case next week, and this is an interesting case. It's going to happen on the 23rd in Zubik versus Burwell, and it has to do with the Affordable Care Act that allows religious nonprofit organizations, as well as closely held for-profits, to opt out of covering contraceptive care. And so this is going to come before the Supreme Court to say whether they have a right to not do this.
Ellen Radner, as always, thank you so much for your information. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And get some sleep after tonight. That's Ellen Radner from Talk Media News. Up next, Neil Lunderville, General Manager of Burlington Electric Department. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome in the WDEV studios Neil Lunderville, General Manager of Burlington Electric.
I was kind of hoping for a Supertramp starting song. Maybe at the break we can get Supertramp one more time.
I do the jokes on the show.
Okay.
What, Neil, you're the General Manager of the Burlington Electric Department. What does the Burlington Electric Department do, and how has it evolved through the years?
Well, first, Mike, thanks for being on the show. It's great to be here and enjoy listening. You and I have known each other for a long time, and I think you found many callings, but this is certainly one of them as a radio host. And great to be in here to talk about Burlington Electric, which I believe is one of the literally one of the nation's most innovative utilities. And it's a real gem in Burlington. It's one that even in as Burlingtonians, we don't talk about it a lot because it works so well. I've been general manager for about 20 months. I came on as interim general manager, and I loved it so much I ended up staying. It's a utility that has been working for years to keep its mission of providing safe, reliable, affordable, and socially responsible energy to our customers. Founded about 111 years ago, coming up on our 111th birthday at the end of April. It's the largest municipal utility in the state, serving just the city of Burlington and the airport, which is a city property as well. We last 2 years ago, we had the distinction of becoming the first city in the United States to source 100% of our power from renewable generation. And this is a really big deal. A lot of utilities around the state, and in Vermont, we have a lot of great utilities. They're all trying to reach the threshold of 40, 50, or 60% renewable with the state's new renewable portfolio standards. Burlington Electric's already there. We've been there for almost 2 years. It's a pretty remarkable achievement. It took about 10 years in the making, and it's one of the hallmarks of a very small, innovative utility like Burlington Electric. You know, if you look around the country, a lot of other utilities, even municipal utilities, maybe especially municipal utilities, aren't really looking at renewables the same way we are here in the U.S. I recently had a national gathering of public power utilities called the American Public Power Association, and I went around, you know, meeting folks there, and I asked them where they're from and what's their power mix like, and almost everybody I met said, well, we're X percent natural gas and 20% coal. And I was like, coal? Holy crow. Who's still got coal? And they're like, well, we run a coal plant. And these are companies that, these are municipal utilities out in the Midwest. And so when I told them at Burlington Electric that we run on 100% renewable generation, it was kind of a big shock to them. You know, how do you do it? And so one of the great stories about BED, and I think this is very telling, you know, the story behind renewables often is, oh boy, 100% renewable, you must be, you know, your customers must be paying through the nose for power. And the opposite is true. We have not raised rates at Burlington Electric since 2009. We have no plans to raise rates anytime soon. And our rates, our blended rates are lower than the statewide average, which is really a testament to the men and women of Burlington Electric who've sought to keep our costs down, despite in some cases bringing in a little bit more expensive power. So there is a path between having renewables and having expensive rates, and we're proving it at BED.
You've answered all my questions. We'll see you later.
I know.
We're speaking with Neil Lunderville, the general manager of Burlington Electric Department. You talk about your energy mix and how it is all renewables, yet some environmentalists believe your energy isn't green enough. What are they talking about?
Well, there's a couple things here. Let me talk to you about what our energy mix is. We are, back 32 years ago, Burlington decided to build a biomass wood chip plant, the McNeil Generating Station in the Intervale. It's a 50-megawatt plant. We burn sustainably harvested wood chips there. Burlington is the managing partner. It's a partnership between BED, GMP, and BIPSA, which are the Organization of Municipal Utilities in Vermont. So we take about half the load from there, about 25 megawatts. That is about 43% of our power. We take another 33% of our power from wind, including the turbines on Georgia Matlin, and other wind power around Vermont. And ultimately around New England, we take 23% from hydro, and I reverse those, 33% from hydro, 23% from wind, and the remainder, just a little bit, about 1% from solar. And, you know, a lot of times people say, well, you know, it's you're still damaging the environment, you're taking down trees to build a solar array, or you're upsetting the natural environment by putting solar or wind in. And you have to step back and really look at what we're doing. So as we are the 100% renewable, we are the largest for our biomass plant. We are the largest purchaser of wood products in Vermont. We through our efforts, more trees are cut down every year than any other endeavor in the state of Vermont. Through hydro, which we own the Winooski One Hydro facility, we buy hydro around Vermont. We have we've plugged up rivers, which you could argue is not good for fish passage and other reasons. For wind, we have raised the top of mountains to build wind turbines. And for solar, we've eaten up green fields and other areas. And I would still argue that we are the most environmentally friendly utility in the United States of America, because we are doing it in the way that's the least impact. When you produce power, the very physics of it means you're going to be destroying something.
So with the environmentalists, because I'm trying to understand this complaint from the environmentalists that you're not green enough. Their complaint is that you don't have enough in solar, perhaps you don't have enough in wind. You burn wood, I guess, is where the issue is.
Well, another complaint is that we sell our renewable energy credits, which we do, and we're really proud to be able to do that. We, with our renewable generation, we are able to sell renewable energy credits down in Connecticut and Massachusetts. We bring about $10 million a year back to our customers, which we can lower their rates with. Which is a pretty big sum. It's more than 15%.
And can you explain what renewable sure. energy credits are?
Yeah, I mean, this is hard to explain. I'm not the best at explaining it, but let me. I've said it this way before. It's like you have a green apple, and you're selling the green off the apple. And you still have the apple. The apple's the energy that's produced, but the green is the renewability part of it. So we can't claim, for instance, that our wind power is renewable. So what we do is when we sell a high-priced REC, so that's a very valuable REC to Connecticut, and we buy back a lower-priced REC to make up for that, so that we have 100% plus of our portfolio covered by renewable energy credits, meaning that we still claim that our power is 100% renewable.
Neil, where's the industry going? Is it in a similar spot that maybe telecommunications was in the mid-1990s, when there was a sort of a revolution going on within telecommunications, and there was upheaval in the telecommunications market? Where are we going with energy?
Well, this is the most fascinating topic on energy today. It is in a very similar spot than telecom was back 20 plus years ago. We have for the last 100 plus years in energy, we have been operating in this kind of hub and spoke model. The hub being a large power producer like a McNeil station or like Vermont Yankee once was, where all the electrons are being produced there and they're being sent out in one direction, more or less, to people's homes and businesses. So you have the hub and the radial feeds out to people's homes. We are moving away from that very, very quickly in energy right now, where the model of having one large producer is going away, where people are putting solar panels on their homes, on their businesses. And we're looking at other ways to produce energy on a very small scale. It's called distributed energy. And in this model, it's moving from this hub and spoke to a network model, where instead of one big hub producing all the electrons, you have a bunch of nodes out there. And all these nodes are producing less energy than the big hub was once, but they're producing enough so that when you network them all together, they can ultimately produce all the energy that we need. This is hugely disruptive in the energy market. And what I find fascinating and exciting, and really exciting for our customers, ultimately, we will have a point when we don't need these big energy producers, or we don't need them in the same way we need them today. We won't need them for the day-to-day baseload power. We might need them for emergencies, etc. And that's a great thing, because what it does is it's putting control back in the hands of our customers, where we are moving from relying on large energy sources and large energy companies, and really taking that control back at a customer level. As a municipal utility, that really excites us, because we are ultimately working for the best interest of our customers. And I think the best interest of our customers is when they have greater control over the energy they produce and the energy they consume. We're lucky in Vermont that all of our utilities are really see it the same way. Green Mountain Power is moving in the same direction. Vermont Electric Co-op is, Washington Electric, et cetera. We're lucky here. In a lot of parts of the country, the big utilities are trying to ignore this. I've heard it, but the companies in other parts of the country have called this to me. They've said, "Well, solar's a fad." A fad? I said, "It's not a fad. It's like the iPhones." They would probably think the iPhone is a fad. You know, when we're going to go back to a large the analog phone, a corded phone. But they really don't see this, in part because they don't want to see it. When we disrupt the established businesses that are operating this hub and spoke model, what we're really telling them is that we're going to strand their assets. We're going to take these large power plants and we're going to make them uneconomic. And that should rightly frighten these large companies. But it's good for our customers, and it definitely is the future of energy.
Doesn't it also disrupt the model of utilities here in Vermont in terms of what they're doing and how they're doing it? Because in the telecommunications industry, for example, competition came in, different forms of competition came in, and the whole business model was turned upside down in terms of how they had to operate and what they had to do, and certainly competition made them, forced them to change that business model. Are we going to see the same thing in utilities here, in electric utilities?
You are, and I certainly hope we do, and I believe we are. The business model of simply selling and making our revenue on a kilowatt hour basis, which has been the model for a long time is going away. People, because of efficiency, because of generation, in-home generation, are going to be needing fewer kilowatt hours from the utility. And unless the utility changes, you enter what they call a utility death spiral, where there's not going to be enough kilowatt hours for us to bill. And people are going to start cutting the cord. It's familiar from telecommunications. They'll cut the line to the utility, and you know, pretty soon there are going to be fewer and fewer customers carrying a bigger and bigger cost to run the poles and wires. As a utility, we need to recognize that's where it's going and get ahead of that. And by what I mean by getting ahead of it is understanding what our customers want and being a partner at their side rather than trying to stand in their way, and which will never work. The tidal wave of customer choice will rule this market, as it rightly should.
We're speaking with Neil Lunderville, the general manager of Burlington Electric. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. I want to turn our conversation to energy efficiency. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Neil Lunderville, the general manager of Burlington Electric Department. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. We're talking all things energy. One of the things that we talked about is that there is a change. There is this massive change going on in how electricity is delivered to the customer. But at the same time, there's this really sort of evolving change in terms of energy efficiency. What's going on there?
Well, when you think about the future of distributed energy and kind of going back to what we said before, breaking out of this hub and spoke model where people are creating their own energy, one of the ways that that works, and one of the only ways that it works, is to is when people are using less energy. In Burlington, Burlington has been a leader in energy efficiency for the last 25 years. Back in 1989, the city of Burlington passed a bond to allow it to start its own energy efficiency utility. You know, in fact, today, Burlington uses less energy than it did in 1990, which is pretty amazing considering the growth that Burlington has seen in industries and in population. But what it means for the future is that people will continue to use less. And we want to help them do that. We are, unlike other utilities in the state, we have our own energy efficiency utility. So that means in Burlington, if a customer wants to do some efficiency measures on their home, they'll call Burlington Electric instead of our good friends at Efficiency Vermont. And we work directly with them to help them update their electric efficiency. So we're doing a couple things that I think are fairly innovative in this space. One is we are thinking a lot about whole home efficiency. So when our customers think about efficiency, they're not energy geeks like we are. They're not thinking, well, I want to do efficiency in my home, and if I'm going to do electric, I'm going to call BED, and if I'm going to do thermal, I'm going to call my Vermont Gas. We're thinking about that as one call, and we've been working very closely with Vermont Gas to develop programs that bring our customers along in that space. For instance, last year we did a program called Energy Champ Challenge, and that was targeted directly at multi-family homes, apartment buildings in Burlington. We have 60% of our customers are renters. They have a hard time because they're renters. They're not going to be doing efficiency measures on a home that they don't own, and so that's a challenge. And on the other side, the landlords aren't necessarily going to do efficiency measures because, well, they don't pay their electric bills. But this Energy Champ Challenge really met in the middle. What we said is we're going to give a great incentive for landlords to do efficiency measures in their multifamily buildings. We had a big goal. We've exceeded our goals and really been able to deliver some great savings for our customers.
I want to come back to what the specifics of those programs and what the specifics of energy efficiency is. But first, I'd like to go to the phone lines. Mike from Huntington. Mike, you're on Open Mic.
Morning, Neil. Good morning, Mike. How are we doing?
Good morning, Mike.
Shut down for mud season. I thought I'd make a comment. Neil and I have had a partnership in business for 15 years or so, and, you know, the naysayers will always be out there, but the procurement program is fantastic. I mean, Vermont's forests are growing, and one of the problems that we're having is low-grade timber, low-value timber. What are we going to do with it? Because, you know, everybody wants to cut good stuff, but the bad stuff, we still have to call that out. And McNeil gives you a great place to take low-grade lumber and timber for the chips. And that's a product that has to come out of the woods anyway. The procurement program is spot on. It's environmentally friendly. I think, you know, probably air is in the way of more environmental friendly than some programs I've seen. But McNeil is doing everything right. And for people to come up against it and say, well, they're not doing this, they're not doing that, I'm guessing they're probably not as educated as they should be making that decision. I hope to continue doing business with McNeil, and I hope that, you know, they continue taking wood as biomass. And I like the fact that hydro and wind and solar are involved in that. And that's my comment. Thanks, guys.
Well, thanks for the phone call, Mike.
Mike, thanks so much. You're one of the hundreds of folks out there who are helping us procure wood and for McNeil. I mentioned before we're the largest single buyer, but it's because of folks like you that we're able to get product in every season. I know right now it's tough because of mud season, but I agree with you. McNeil is an amazing resource for Vermont and for the rural economy in Vermont. One thing I didn't note before is that when Vermont Yankee shut down, McNeil became the largest energy producer in the state of Vermont. We're the largest electricity producer right in Burlington in the Intervale with a 50-megawatt plant. We do practice sustainable harvest of the wood, as you well know, and all of our wood plans are approved by Fish and Wildlife Department. We're very, very proud of the work that we do and the four foresters that we have at McNeil do a really great job working directly with the loggers to get a great product year in, year out. So thank you.
We've seen generations sort of decline over the years here in the state of Vermont, and as you said, the McNeil plant is the largest generator in the state of Vermont. Is that a problem?
Yeah, at a lot of levels it is a problem. You know, if you look at some of the charts about how much energy, how much electricity Vermont produces relative to how much we consume, it is really upside down. We produce very little and consume quite a bit relative to other states. Part of the reason is that when Vermont Yankee shut down, that's when it really disrupted. I mean, that was obviously our largest producer by a 10x factor as compared to McNeil. Long term, in order to be more energy self-sufficient, we do need more generation. But one of the ways so it's two parts. One, we need more generation, but we also need continued efficiency. If we continue to lower the amount of energy that we use and we find ways to be more efficient and reduce demand, we're going to need less renewable or less generation, period. And we can't lose sight of that efficiency. I know it's not, you know, with all the talk about solar and everything else, efficiency does not seem very sexy anymore, but it is hugely important. It's the bedrock of the future of energy is becoming more efficient in our homes and businesses. And without it, you know, we really are not going to be able to achieve the goals that we want in the state.
Let's turn to efficiency. We talked a little bit about sort of the overall goals of efficiency, but what does that mean? What does that mean to the residential customer? What does that mean to the business customer?
Well, ultimately, we are looking, you know, the bottom line goal is to help our customers save money. I mean, that is it. When we're talking about efficiency, we want them to buy less electricity by having more efficient measures in their home. Whether that be for homes, it might look more like the light bulbs and the efficient appliances that folks, I think, know pretty well. But for businesses, it's a whole range of options. I mean, the technology around efficiency has really come a long way in the last couple decades. So you're not just talking about efficient light bulbs. You're looking at motion sensors to turn lights on and off. You're looking at energy-efficient pumps, at energy-efficient systems in their buildings that can really cut down cost. A lot of businesses don't realize they have some real energy hogs down in their boiler room that we can work with them to make more efficient. And I want to mention our great partnership with Vermont Gas. I mention that because, you know, in Burlington, 95% of our homes and businesses are on natural gas. It's a huge part of the energy mix. And so with Burlington Electric, we're focused on electricity, yes, but we're really focused on saving our customers money. So we're looking at more than electricity. We're looking at electricity, and we're looking at the thermal side, and we're starting to look at the transportation side. Are there ways to help our customers get into electric vehicles and help them save money on fuel? Although the price of gas is really low right now, you know, long term, I would bet that the price of oil isn't going to stay in the 30s. It's probably going to go up. And I think using electric power for our vehicles makes a lot of sense, especially in Burlington when we're sourcing it from 100% renewable generation.
One of the things I'm curious, and as I'm listening to you, I'm trying to figure out how the business model works, because if you look down the road from what you've said, people are going to build and consume less energy. They're going to build more efficiently, consume less energy. They're going to cut the cord because there's other options that they have available for them, whether it's solar, whether it's wind. So how does a utility stay in business?
Well, it's a great question, and it is the question that utilities are grappling with right now. I think when we say they're going to cut the cord, let's understand what that means. Even with a cell phone, you don't fully cut the cord, because your cell phone isn't communicating directly with my cell phone. It's communicating through a series of backhaul networks that operate in the state in the same way, or in the nation. Which are wired networks, which are hardwired networks. In the same way, people will need to be connected to the utility. And our customers don't want to be disconnected. They want solar. They want storage, which we haven't talked about, battery storage. They want to be more efficient, but they don't want to become energy. They don't want to become energy geeks. They want to worry about, are they going to make it to their kid's soccer game in time? They want us at Burlington Electric, or us at other utilities, to be the ones to manage this for them. And the way we manage it is to keep them connected. Now, they have, if something goes wrong on the grid, now they can fall back on their battery storage and on their solar, so they have a lot more reliability and resiliency. Although in Burlington, we have a highly reliable network, probably one of some of the fewest outages in the state. I think that's the case. But being connected does allow them to be part of this bigger community, meet community goals, and ultimately give them that real reliability that they're looking for.
We're speaking with Neil Lunderville, who is the general manager of Burlington Electric Department. If you have a comment or an opinion, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Bill in Johnson. Bill, you're on open mic.
Good morning. Let me apologize for any road noise. Two things. One is that it's great that these folks are concerned with electrical efficiency, but Vermonters' average residential energy needs are predominantly heating. So I'm going to plug shamelessly hybrid solar. It's a water-based solar preheating system. They come in a variety of configurations for new and older homes. And you can go to radianttech.com. I've owned one for 10 years. It paid for itself in 5. And there's the plug. Radiant Tech is spelled with a C at the end.
And we'll send you a bill for advertising, Bill.
They don't give me nothing, but I'm just a happy customer.
Okay.
And I'm actually about to build another house to retire in, and I will do the same system.
Okay.
But what I wanted to say is I live in Lamoille County. Clearly, there is an ideal site for a McNeil-type system, which would, as the previous caller mentioned, increase the viability of forest products in the state. And that is the pre-existing brownfield of the Vermont Asbestos Group, the former Eden Lowell asbestos mine. The main site with the main building is an existing brownfield, easily redeemable, and it is connected to the right power line. It's connected to the right market for coal. It's in the center of the northern forest, and it has its own
exit ramp off Route 118. I mean, this thing is ideal. And we've been talking about this for years up here. If you know anybody, an investor or other people in your business, sir, if you could encourage them to take a look at it, it would be a great boon to Vermont's energy production supply as well as Pamoil County.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate the phone call.
Hey, Bill, thanks for the call. I want to just on your first point, agree with you that we need to look at both electric and thermal efficiency in everything that we do. On the second point, one other point on biomass is that, you know, McNeil is a rarity in electricity in that it is baseload renewable. Unlike wind and solar, which are intermittent, McNeil is baseload. It is on 24/7. It is dispatchable power. And even hydro does a pretty good job with baseload, but it's not baseload like biomass is baseload. So I want to give another plug for it. It's a way that we keep the lights on 24/7 in Vermont.
We're speaking with Neil Lunderville, General Manager of the Burlington Electric Department. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Neil Lunderville, who's the General Manager of Burlington Electric Department. Neil, we've talked about a lot of issues, but one of the issues that interests me, new construction, a lot's going on in new construction, whether it's in Japan or in Europe, in terms of how to design, how to build a house that uses less energy, and there's a lot going on in battery technology. Can you explain?
Yeah, they're both really fascinating topics. Around new construction and even retrofit construction, there's a technology that we've been looking at a lot at called passive house technology. It comes out of Europe, but it has a lot of it's been applied here. And the whole idea of it is that we can build homes and buildings, not just homes, but office buildings, to the point where they really don't need much energy at all. I mean, you could put a solar panel on top and even for a pretty good sized building, have enough electricity to run the whole home. And this technology really looks at creating a very tight envelope with the home and with enough insulation so that in winter it stays warm and in summer it stays cool. These technologies for new construction, we see models where building to passive house standard can pay itself back very, very quickly within a couple of years. With retrofits, it's a little harder because you're dealing with an existing structure, especially in a city like Burlington that has a lot of old historic homes. It makes it a little bit more difficult. But that's not to say we can't take lessons from passive house and other standards like this to start building or rebuilding up to a higher, more energy efficient standard. And I think that's one of the ways we lower demand in the future when we look at new buildings. Let's really look at the whole building, make sure all of our systems are talking with each other. So our electrical systems are talking to our thermal systems, that they're cooperating with the building envelope and the doors and the windows. All of these things fit together. And the construction today, we're just starting to do that. You know, there are some developers that do that, but a lot of them just say, well, we're going to build a place and we're going to leave room for the boiler guy to come in and put a boiler in, and we're going to leave room for the electrical folks to come in and install the electrical. We need to start thinking about a building as one building. All these systems need to be working and talking together.
And is that what they're doing in Europe and in Japan? They're looking at this as a whole?
They're looking at it as a whole building. So when your general contractor won't just leave a space for the boiler and for the thermal side. They'll actually have all the contractors in and say, all right, let's design to a different standard, an interconnected web of technologies that are going to be working together. Because as you know, Bill, the caller earlier, talked about, there are technologies that blend solar hot water with solar photovoltaic, and they can come together to create one system for the home. Our minds need to be thinking like that instead of segmenting electric and thermal and other components kind of separately. These all work together as one. One of the other technologies that fits in there, as you mentioned, is energy storage. Particularly on electric storage, the technology around batteries for homes and businesses is really coming along. And batteries are the real difference maker when it comes to the future of energy. When we can make electrons during the day with solar, store those electrons for nighttime use, it really creates a platform where you can think about, you know, quote, disconnecting from the grid, because you can be self-sufficient around the clock. Now, again, if in Vermont, like, you don't see the sun for a week or two, you're going to need to be connected to the grid at some point. But the storage, battery storage, really changes that conversation.
One of the issues in terms of energy that has been somewhat controversial is the siting of energy projects, whether they're solar or wind. What's your opinion on siting?
Yeah, I would say that our energy siting policy that's in Section 248 in state statute was built for a different era. It came about when we were building large power plants like Vermont Yankee or like McNeil, where it would have been difficult, if not impossible, to allow for local siting, because no one would have ever wanted to site a nuclear or even a wood-fired plant anywhere. So the state took that over. Now, when you talk about doing that at a level for solar projects, it seems like we've got a mismatch between old-style regulation and new-style generation. I think there's a place in the middle where local residents can have more, local residents and local governments can have more control over that without losing sight of the state goals to put more renewable generation in. There is a balancing act in there, and I think a responsible relook at the regulation makes some sense.
How do people keep informed about what you're doing at Burlington Electric?
Well, they can go to our website at burlingtonelectric.com. They can follow us on Twitter at Burlington Elec, ELEC. They can go to our Facebook page. They can tune into Open Mic, which is going to be one of our – we'll be here every week at this time from now on.
You'll pay.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll find a sponsor for that with one of our renewable energy partners. But those are the ways to stay informed. And if you're a customer, you know, give us a call. Stop in to our Pine Street office. We love our customers, and we have great employees. We love our customers, and we want to help our customers and all Vermonters learn more about energy and become more energy efficient and create this new energy platform together.
Thank you, Neil Lunderville, General Manager of Burlington Electric.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. I also want to thank John Walters from Vermont Political Observer. He was in earlier talking about state and national politics. And tomorrow, it's all politics. We'll do a rundown of what happened in the primaries. And our guest tomorrow will be Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus at Middlebury College, and Garrett Graff, who is the former editor of Politico. And also, if you missed any portion of this program, you can go on our WDEVradio.com website and click on the Open Mic podcast icon. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, as I just said, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll talk again tomorrow.